Regina Bain has started all three seasons of At the Podium. And when you hear our conversation this time, you will understand why. This season, I want to explore the legacies we leave behind. And the answers all vary significantly, as varied as what the word legacy means to the guests who sit with me. But even as we think about leaving legacies for other people, we need to also think about the space that we create for ourselves. The legacies that we leave are both exterior, those that impact the lives and the DNA of people known and unknown to us, and they are interior, the unseen places within ourselves that we hold only for us. As the executive director of the Louis Armstrong House Museum and Archives, Regina is daily touching the legacy of one of the greatest artists of the 20th century. She is also discovering the spaces of creativity within herself to find, as she says, the dimensionalities of legacy. Hello and welcome to At the Podium with me, Patrick Huey. At the Podium is a multimedia platform where story by story, we explore the resiliency of the human spirit with people who are using their own personal journeys to leave a positive and transformative imprint on our world today. At the Podium holds a space for meaningful conversation, inspiration, and life. Today, I'm thrilled to share the podium with Regina Bain. Regina Bain is an artist and educator serving as the executive director of the Louis Armstrong House Museum and Archives. Previous to her appointment at LAM, Ms. Bain served as associate vice president of the Posse Foundation, a national leadership and college access program. Bain's efforts helped to increase Posse's national student graduation rates for four consecutive years. Bain is currently the co-chair of Culture at Three's Anti-Racism Subcommittee, and she serves on the National Advisory Council of Urban Bushwomen. She also serves on the Yale Board of Governors. Ms. Bain is committed to social justice. She facilitates and trains others to facilitate conversations on social identity, leadership, and group dynamics. Ms. Bain earned her BA in African American Studies and Theater from Yale University and received her MFA from the Yale School of Drama. Ms. Bain was also the first guest to appear on seasons 1 and 2 of At the Podium. Regina, welcome back again.
Thank you.
At the Podium.
It's good to be here.
It is good to see your face. How have you been? You've had a big 2023. How are you feeling as you walk toward these last couple of weeks of 2023?
Feeling a sense of possibility, of nostalgia, of looking back and looking forward. This is the year that we opened the new Armstrong Center across the street from the historic house. So this is Louis Armstrong's legacy that I'm sitting in and helping to move forward. And it's been a whirlwind. I didn't know how many construction meetings I would need to be in at the beginning of this role. Valves and HVAC. But also conversations about legacy have permeated this experience. Mm. And for artists, for people. And that has been a beautiful journey to be on.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny because as I was thinking about what season 3 was going to be, the thing that instantly came to my mind was, what is legacy? You know, I've talked about people finding their voice and, you know, what are those leaps of faith that people have had to take? But for this season, the idea of legacy and what we leave behind and really resonated within me when I was going back and forth, and I took a long time to figure out, is there even going to be a season 3? This idea of what we leave behind, and maybe it's my age, you know, we've had such an unbelievable few years. So maybe all of that is like, okay, so what is the thing that we're leaving behind? And you kind of know what sparked it, Regina, was that You know I love history, right? So you know I love history. And I was sort of on my phone. I was on my phone and I was deleting emails just to create more space on my phone. And I was like, I'm literally deleting parts of my life. Yes. That nothing anyone's going to ever read them, but these things are gone. And I was like, so what's left behind? If everything is so disposable and then we can close our Instagram accounts and Facebook accounts and delete them and all that information, those pictures are gone. What do we tangibly leave behind that says that we were actually here?
There's a word that I learned coming into this role, and that's archivist. And it's a role, it's a fancy word for someone who remembers and cares for memories through tangible things like pieces of paper, programs and pictures, and but also puts writing to those memories. And it's a profession. You can be an archivist for any number of institutions, but you can also be an archivist in your family. There, all of us probably have that one, that aunt, that uncle, that cousin, that someone who keeps things and yeah. has them in a scrapbook and helps to tell the family story. And how are we archiving our own lives? Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, we have to feel that our lives are worthy of being remembered.
Ooh.
That picture, that program, that memory is worthy of being kept and chronicled. Yeah. And that someone will be interested in learning about it. That's a journey to go through as a person, as a family, as an institution. You're worthy of being remembered. There's something that you can pass forward that is of worth. That's a journey, and it's a good journey to be on.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I have been in this space where I am reevaluating what my dreams have been. Mm-hmm. And it's related. I think the dreams are perhaps the initial manifestations of the things that we hope to achieve. Those things that we hope to achieve become the things that become our legacy. That legacy becomes a thing that lingers after we've left the planet. And so I think those initial dreams that we have are the sort of blueprints, the floor plans of what the legacy and the things that we leave behind. It's very real to me now because as we're shooting this, I'm in Nashville, where I went to undergrad at Vanderbilt. So I'm walking through those spaces again. And the dreams that were dreamed there with my friends, the dreams that we dreamed together at Yale, for most of us have shifted because you just live, right? But they were like the initial passes at being the archivists of our own lives, I think, those dreams that we held. You know what I mean?
I do. And for me, I remember dreaming when I was a very little girl that I wanted to think about teaching, that I wanted to think about writing. And at some point I said theater. That was a choice and a spirit choice, but there are different parts of myself that theater didn't fulfill. And so I was looking for those other pieces as well. And part of my life's journey has been trying to find the professional activities that fulfill the entirety of my being. That's very hard to do. And I've discovered that some of it is profession and some of it is not. It's just about life. How are you living your life to fulfill the things that are important to you? What's important to me is art, and that the freedom to think and feel and that provocative art, that's important to me. It's important for me to be a part of, to make happen. And the thinking part of it, that art makes people think, I can fulfill in other ways than being on the stage. I can fulfill by being a person that makes the stage for other people, that makes space for people to think. And that's been a journey to know there's a core of what I want to do. It's about preparing incredible, experiential, living activities for human beings. You can do that on stage. You can do that off stage. You can do that one-on-one. You can do that with thousands. And that's the journey I've been on.
Do you not miss the applause, public nature of that?
No, because what I loved about theater, what I still love about theater, is being in front of another human being, the way I'm in front of you right now, and speaking to them and feeling them and having that produce a meaning, reveal a meaning for me and for the people who are watching, hopefully. Experience, that's the provocative piece of that. The applause is nice, but I really liked class. I liked class because I got to rehearse what it means to be human with another human being in front of me. That's what I love the most about theater.
Mm.
Do you miss the applause?
I do. I think because my love language I've learned is validation, like words, and applause is a form of a validation like that. I also miss when we stepped into those rehearsal halls, we were working at an incredibly high level, which I didn't even realize we were doing until I left and started working with people who hadn't been through what we'd been through. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah. But I miss that process, that collaborative process with people who could walk the walk and talk the talk. And I still think that art as a whole can move people in a way that nothing else can.
I agree.
And that the theater, a great television show, a great movie, has a unique space within that because it brings everything together. It's not a singular experience. So there's something that happens in community, I think is really interesting. And I wonder if it's just a function of getting older, but looking back at my time at Yale and at Vanderbilt, I just feel such gratitude for that experience that I didn't have for it in real time. And there's something when you're working on a play, and I think it may be specific to theater because of how you rehearse a play and how a play is built. You're really trying to figure it out. And it's you and a group of people trying to unlock this thing that are words on a page. And how do you make that? How do you do it together? How do you make it authentic? How do you make it resonate for people? So, I mean, that's what I miss, you know, that's what I miss.
Last night, I was at a concert in the jazz room of the new Armstrong Center. And this amazing artist, Amira Leon, was performing. She is an Armstrong Now artist in residence. And she had a band, a piano, upright bass, violin, drums, trumpet. And she talked about experiences that made her appreciate life because it wasn't always certain that she would have that.
Mm-hmm.
And every experience after that was so precious and beautiful. And she wanted to be present and make sure that we in the audience were present to the gift of this moment. And then her band and she created sound. And it's like a play, but without words. It is an intention. They were asking questions, and then they would come to an answer. And you could see and feel the joy in them finding the answer sonically.
Mm.
Searching, finding, oh my goodness, and now it's settled into something else. And oh, we're searching again. And oh my goodness, we found it. And oh, sonically, I am thankful to be in those rooms with musicians. And I think particularly jazz musicians, that this is the tradition,
yeah,
of having an incredible foundation in technique that allows you to be with other humans in the space, search, ask questions, and find the answers. Whether it's sonically, whether it's with words, that's what I love about art. And I found that last night. And coupled with death, frankly, there's been a lot of death for me personally, and I think for many of us in these last few years, the appreciation of life that comes and the appreciation of art within that. I felt that last night. And that's really important for my work and my life and my art.
Yeah, you know, we have had a lot of death this year.
We have.
We lost three of our classmates who were at school with us at Yale when we were at school. And I think the passing of Leslie Elliard, who was the class beneath us, he was 46, died in his sleep. But that sort of like shook me a little bit, because we were in fame with Leslie, you know? And to lose a light really struck me. And then to lose Rio, who was in our class just right before Thanksgiving, the week of Thanksgiving, and made all of these things feel much more acute. So perhaps that is what has made me feel even more, you know, this ain't a dress rehearsal.
No, it's not.
You know, and you look back at, you know, it was so funny. As I was walking around the Vanderbilt campus yesterday, I was looking for my dorm, which is torn down from when I was there. And outside of the dorm was this young guy who turns out to be, he was a senior graduating. And I asked him, I said, you know, is this Vanderbilt Hall? He's like, oh no, this building was built here 10 years ago. So Vanderbilt Hall has been gone a very long time. But he was telling me that he was a senior. He was moving to San Francisco to work in robotics, doing something I had no idea what he was talking about, what he was going to be doing, you know. But I saw in him that really looking forward to what his life outside of this institution, what his life was probably like. And it just, it even drove home more the point that we have these phases of life, I suppose. And, you know, Tennessee Williams described it in The Glass Menagerie, that the country's finger tips were being forcibly pressed on Braille, you know, to sort of read in darkness and misunderstanding of a failing economy, you know, that during the Depression, which is such a like powerful image. But it seems that yes, we are in these moments of great expansion, contraction, and still being forced, our fingertips forced on the braille of a failing economy of life.
Lord, Tennessee! This is what I mean by art provoking, making you think and feel. It's tangible. I can see it. I can feel it. The fingers pressing down on ridges and bumps in order and being made to learn physically. I think that's what these last couple of years have been. I think this what this next year is going to be. I feel like I'm being physically forced to learn. My fingertips, my whole body is being pressed against some bumpy terrain, and I am being physically forced to learn. I don't want to learn through death. But our three classmates from Yale School of Drama, near classmates, two of my classmates from undergrad, five of my family members, gone. And, oh, it's hard. But what I want to take from that is, and I'm resisting the pressure of what I will say is God's hand pressing my fingertips and my body against those ridges. I'm resisting, but I'm starting to surrender into the learning and into the appreciation of the beauty of being able to feel the bumps.
Yeah.
That is a gift. I don't want to feel sometimes, but that is a gift. And it's also the responsibility of an artist to feel, definitely of an actor. I think of a musician. I think of artists to feel the bumps and try and translate them for other people and give them the room and the space to feel it too, and be able to learn from it, to not be so damaged by it that they can't learn, but to put it in a form that we can actually learn from it.
Yeah.
That's what I think artists do well. That's what I'm in rehearsal for. and on stage for right now in my life is to surrender to the bumps, to experience them, to learn from them, to help others to do the same. Ooh, Tennessee. Mm. And to you for remembering that.
Well, you know he's my favorite. You know he's my favorite playwright. I've always loved Tennessee.
Yes.
Yeah. You went to the Middle East this year with Lam. Mm-hmm. And there's a quote from you on the U.S. Department of State's website. Do you know that?
Yes.
Okay.
I saw it in glance. Yes, I know it's there.
So here's the quote that you said, because you went to Bahrain, mm-hmm. and you said, "Art and embassies actualizes the value of cultural exchange, creating relationships rooted in ideals that go beyond language and that may make the difference when individuals, organizations, or governments must make the decision whether to turn away or engage." As Louis Armstrong says, a note is a note in any language. If we all understand the music, perhaps that establishes the trust and opens the door for us to understand more. Now, my first question, just so that people understand, why did the U.S. Department send you to the Middle East? Why did they send you there? And what was your mission? And what did you teach? And what did you learn on that?
Yes. So Louis Armstrong, amazing trumpet player, vocalist, America's first Black icon, traveled to 62 different countries. So the world knows him. And people from America travel through the world. And there is an amazing ambassador from America to Bahrain who was moving there for the first time. And he was setting up his home. And Art and Embassies, as a part of the U.S. State Department, helps an ambassador to feel at home in their space, in their new place, and literally to put art into their homes. And this ambassador wanted art about jazz and about Louis Armstrong in particular. So the State Department came to us and said, "Can we borrow some things?" And we said yes, and sent them over. And then the State Department said, "Can you come and talk about the things that you sent?" Because the ambassador would like to have a conversation with he and with the community that he's built about this. And so I went. And it was my first time traveling internationally after COVID. First time to the Middle East at all. So I had anxiety and concern. And I'm so glad that I went. And I learned a great deal. I learned firsthand how beloved Louis Armstrong is in many places in the world, because the people there knew him and were telling me stories about him and the things that they knew. And then there were things that I could share that they didn't know, and share more about the context of race in America that made Louis Armstrong and that made his ability to travel the world, to go to the South, to have music that was appreciated by many races, why that was a miracle. Yeah. In the context of race in the United States, but also in these cultural contexts that in other countries that are different. So it was a gift to be able to do that and to know that that can be the beginning. I got to go to Germany with the Das Minsk Museum in Potsdam, where Jason Moran, who curated our exhibit in Queens, worked with the executive director of Das Minsk. And they curated a conversation about Louis Armstrong when he went to Germany, when the wall was up, and how he was engaged in a conversation about democracy and freedom in a space that didn't have it. And that was amazing to go there and see people who had pictures of Louis Armstrong in their personal archives and were bringing it back after 50 years to share. I like traveling. It breaks me open in a way that is very important. And I know that you travel a great deal. You were stationary for a while, semi-stationary.
A little bit. Yeah.
But you went out into the world too. And so I'm wondering what that was like and what you found when you went into the world. How has it changed? How have you changed?
This time around, I've been spending a lot of time in Eastern Europe, which is it's not super different, but we have a different relationship to Eastern Europe because much of it was not available to us for so many decades. So I've been spending a lot of time in Eastern Europe and really moved by the culture of people who have been oppressed and how even under the specter of communism and authoritarianism, so many of those countries and those civilizations thrived. Their art thrived. Their cuisine thrived. Their education continues to thrive. But there's a roughness to it because it's not polished. It's not, you know, the Mona Lisa isn't behind a glass form with a rope line that you have to sort of, when I went to see Gustav Klimt's Kiss, you could almost touch it when I was in Austria. I think it was the Belvedere. You could almost touch it. It felt much more, again, the Tennessee Williams image of the fingers being forcibly pressed upon a braille of a failing economy to kind of experience. It feels just a little bit more real to me. You see the human struggle, you know, when you're in these countries, and you also bump up against so many more different types of people and races and ethnicities than we do in the US. I mean, we're so spread out. We're so far removed that when you start going overseas into these different countries, you really have to interact with humanity in a way that we kind of don't do that here just because we're very far removed. So that's been what it's like for me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one thing that traveling a lot has taught me is the American culture has been very well exported. I was having dinner in Buda and the server was probably in college. I don't know how old he was. His English was flawless. And I asked him, I said, why is your English as good as it is? And he's like, oh, in school, you're two-track the whole time. You're learning English. And they watch American television and they listen to American music. So you're in the middle of Budapest and you're talking to someone who sounds like they were on 90210 because mm-hmm. they're watching television out of California. The cultural exchange is very interesting because you're like, oh, in many ways, the American experiment worked because the culture got exported mm-hmm. in really profound ways, in ways that you don't even think about. You know, that our music is there. Our TV shows are there. And it's a great responsibility, right? When you start exporting culture to different places and what you say and what you put out becomes really important.
I'm fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by colonialism, but also cultural colonialism. And what specifically in my work, what jazz meant to the world, but broadly for what we as Americans, what we export and the responsibility, as you said, for that. And so how can we be thoughtful about that? But when something goes out there, when music goes out there, when it comes back to us, it is an opportunity for a dialogue.
Yeah.
And it needs to be a dialogue. It needs to not be one way, but it is the opportunity for a dialogue. And so that's what I'm excited to engage in, to figure out what jazz has meant to the world and what we need to learn by from how it changed, mutated, transformed in the spaces that it landed. Because it's not the same. There's something different there. And let's learn from that and bring it back here and bring it back home and see what it feels like here. So I'm curious what you've been bringing home from your travels.
What I bring back is this idea of wherever I go, I am a citizen. I'm a part of that place. I feel like when I go to these different cities and places, it's really about what can I soak up and learn and adopt and take in to broaden my view. But when I go to these places and I am a part of this human experience, this human experiment. And I think it teaches me the broadness of humanity, the beauty of humanity, and that we are not our governments. When I was walking through this museum in Budapest or, you know, at the Christmas market in Bratislava, Nobody was political. Nobody was talking about that. We're all getting in line trying to get the hot apple cider or the warm, hot red wine or the pancakes, the fried pancakes with the applesauce on them, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, humanity is bigger than just like these institutions that we've built to sort of like bring order, you know, that the human experience is a shared experience and it's an experience that brings us together. When you travel, you see that in real time. It's not just hyperbole or poetry. It's the real deal. And so that's what I experience when I'm overseas.
That's why I love science fiction, because it often, and because it requires a complete change of thinking for the current ways that we have broken down society. Mm-hmm. And to say that it can be completely different. And so let's imagine it. I love science fiction for that reason. And I also love it because it often asks the question, what is going to be our legacy as humanity, as a human race? We can think about that. We can also bring it back down. I'm curious, as you enter into this season 3, that's thinking about legacy, how are you thinking about legacy? What are you leaving behind? What do you intend?
Thinking about legacy in terms of the choices we make, the dreams we have, and how does that legacy have to scale? Does it have to be big, or can it just be my legacy is I was here? I think there's something there. And I think as I get older, as my dreams shift, I think, well, where do I want to spend my time? Because that's where your legacy will be. And being open to the surprise of it all. Because I don't have those answers. You know, I wish I had them, but I don't have them today.
I think it's good to be in a process of discovery about those things. What I love when you said, I'm thinking about my legacy, and maybe my legacy is that I was here. That really hit me, because we are here. That is not to be taken for granted. I think about my grandmother, Wilhelmina. She was 98 when she passed. And I thought about that recently when I was struggling with these people in my life who have passed. And I thought, wait, everyone she knew passed before she did. Basically, unless it was her children, all of her peers, she lived long enough to see all of them pass and to experience all of that loss, and to think about and to have time to really think about the things that she did not accomplish, because I know she had some dreams that did not come true. And yet, there was beauty.
Yeah.
And when I was, I don't know if I actually heard these words, but when she went in the hospital, I thought I heard her say in the throes of, she was not quite conscious, but I thought I heard her say, it's time. And just what kind of life you have to live to come to the moment to realize it's time.
It's time.
Oh, that's a gift. And I feel like that's a journey that we're on, to be able to come and settle into a moment when we know it's time. It ain't that time yet.
No, but you know what? It circles back to what you said earlier too. And you just struck me with that, you know, even as we look at the changes that we have to make in our own lives and the cycles and seasons of our own lives, there is that moment when it's time. It's time to say goodbye to something, hello to something else. It's time to... I'm also curious about this idea of what we let go of, you know, in addition to legacy, because a legacy, stepping into effect, is letting go. You're not here anymore, or you're not there where you were before. And I wonder, in your life, your career, what you've had to let go of to have the life that you're living that's so amazing today.
When I started working for a college access nonprofit, I was there for 17 years. I let go of acting. I don't think I had to let go of it at the time. I felt that I needed to let go of it because I felt that I was stepping into something different. I think for younger people nowadays, that phrase. There's a sense that professional activities can encompass many things, and you don't have to let go of some aspect of yourself to do one to do something else. You don't have to be a lawyer forever, or just a lawyer. You don't have to be just anything. You can have multiple professional activities that are speaking to who you are. I think that's more of a sensibility now. But at some point in my life, I thought I had to let go. But there was a time when I'd been at an organization, a posse for 17 years, when I was like, it's time. I have to let go of this place that has been comfortable, comfortable in.
Yeah.
I have to let go of comfort. It's time to get uncomfortable. I've had to let go of comfort a lot to get what I want. And I like that. I like that process of, even though I don't like it, you have to get uncomfortable. You have to be comfortable with being uncomfortable and letting go of that place that you are used to is necessary. And I've done that many times. I'm so excited for this third season for you. And I know there was a big gap between seasons, and there were probably some questions in there. So I'm wondering what those questions were in that gap. I'm wondering if there will be a fourth season. That's to the future, but still, what were those questions in the gap? Will there be a fourth?
The questions in the gap were, because you had said to me when I first started, you were like, it's a lot of work. You had said that to me. And I was like, yeah, it is a lot of work. So it's a lot of work. I know everybody has a podcast now, but most disappear because people realize, oh, this is a lot of work, unless you have a team who's doing it for you. And then I didn't know. I had two questions. One, what did I want to talk about with people? And then this idea of legacy started it literally just kind of came to me. I was like, oh, this is going to be a time about legacy. And then I was like, I don't know who I even want to talk to. And then I had to get sort of right about my intentions around wanting to do all of this anyway. Will there be a season four? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I guess I definitely am not doing 34 episodes for season three. Like I've done 34 for the last 2 years. That's a lot of time and work. I say I won't do 34, then I end up doing 34. But I don't know if there are 34 people out there that I want to talk to about, you know, honestly. And will there be a season four? Potentially. I don't, you know, people are still watching the first two seasons. Like I still watch the numbers go up, which is fascinating to me. Because it really, you know, when you put something out there like this, it lives forever. It never goes away. I guess unless you take it down, but even then it doesn't really go away.
Talk about legacy.
And so it's interesting to me to see people, like sometimes I'll check in and just see how the different episodes are performing. And I'll be like, why did 50 people just watch that episode? It hits for some reason. So I think there's value there. I think for me too, it's like process, like how I want to do it. I want to be in person with people. I want to like have the three cameras and have the like, let's do this. Like, let's feel each other's energy, which is kind of hard to do over Zoom sometimes. But that might be a thing to sort of have to resolve in season four, maybe even season three, who knows?
That can happen.
That can happen. I think I'm also, I'm being very candid with you right now. We'll see if this makes the cut. But I'm like, also, can this dream be real? Can this dream be worth dreaming? Do you know what I mean?
What does real mean in this context?
What do you, I don't understand the question. Ask again.
You said, can this dream be real?
Can this dream be real? Can the impact, the reach that I really think these episodes have been worthy of really be there? Mm. Can the work have the resonance that I think it should have, that I want it to have? That's what I mean.
So Armstrong made thousands and thousands of hours of self-recorded audio. brought reel-to-reel tapes. He had a portable one. He had one at home. He would turn it on when he was having parties, fights with his wife. He would record himself listening to the bells in another country in a hotel room when he was all alone. He would just turn it on. And we have that now. And we can listen to him in a hotel room alone, listening to the bells at Christmas and hear the scratches of him writing a note, a letter. I don't know. I think he knew we would want to listen to it. He had no way of knowing who would listen, how many would listen. That piece of the technology was not available yet.
Yeah.
He could just record and store and preserve. Later came the ability to digitize, to share. I think there's value. I think there's immense value in recording. And then a decade from now, the numbers keep ticking up on season one.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's Peter in the Bible. Or was it Paul? Or was it Moses? Who was like, who am I to go and do this thing, God, that you want me to do? Like, go save the Israelites from the Egyptians, or go convert the world to Christianity, or whatever the charge was. And I really feel like, okay, sometimes who am I to do this thing? To me, it's a question you have to ask yourself. Who are you to do it? And then, you know, sometimes the answer is, I'm not the person to do it, or who am I not to do it? Like, I think in everything in between all of that. But also, I feel like of all the things that I've done, that this is the mission. This is like the Dharma, which freaks me out a little bit, because I'm like, you know, and then I'm like, but what if I fail? And then I hear the Lady Macbeth line, but screw your, you fail, but screw your courage to the sticking place, and will not fail. So yeah, it's complex.
Mr. Hugh, I love your connection to text. I love it. You pull those quotes from many different texts to bring into your life. I love it. I love that. Yeah. Those are the questions we struggle with. I think it's a good struggle.
It is. Okay, Regina, so the season, I want to talk about legacy. So what do you think is the RHB?
I don't know. But I do know. What do I know?
A lot.
Thank you. I know that the word love encompasses many things. It's romantic love. It's familial love. It's friendship love. Yeah. It's love of self. The word legacy is equally as encompassing. It is connected to children. It is connected to text. It is connected to music and art. It is connected to memories that you are a part of that you have no idea for someone else that lives now in their body and in their families. It is the butterfly effect. All of that is legacy. It's the fact that I'm breathing. A legacy is being left, whether I want to or not.
Yes.
It's about how do I want to try and shape that legacy? What is my intentionality? I'm working on that. I think part of what I've heard myself say in two other conversations is one that was private, another that was public, is that my legacy, my mission, part of my mission in life is to create space for artists, literal space, a building being built, money to give them salary, philosophical space to be vulnerable and think about concepts, to create space for others to be and to work, artists in particular, but people broadly. I think that's part of my mission. And each time I've said that, I said, that's true, but that's not quite enough. There's another part of my mission that is about me and creating space for me.
Oh.
And how can I start to articulate that, to hone that, to be intentional about that in the spaces that I am in now? Someone asked me, who was an artist in residence, she's like, do you ever create your own? And I said, no. And I gave the response that I just talked about. But I'm glad she asked the question, because now I'm like, yeah, I need to create space for my own practice. Yeah. I view the work I do now as very creative, but there's another dimensionality to creation, another dimensionality to love, to legacy, that I want to explore. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm up to now.
Oh.
Finding the dimensionalities of legacy.
See, this is why you start every season.
I'm hugging you virtually.
Oh my gosh. Well, Regina, I'll say it again. Thank you for your time, your heart, your energy. Grateful always, because I know we're both busy. And I hope to those people who are watching or listening that you think about your legacy, what you're leaving behind, the people you're impacting. And I hope that you use your voice, your resources, your heart wisely. Bye, everyone.